Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
So as I was saying, time for our Friday gathering. This week I'm joined by Minister of State for Sport and Physical Education, Fianna Fáil TD for Meath East, Thomas Byrne, Paul Murphy, People Before Profit TD for Dublin South West, Elaine Loughlin, Political Editor at the Irish Examiner, and Brenda Power, Columnist at the Irish Daily Mail and Sunday Times. The Biden visit's been only the real sort of story in town this week. Thomas, when you think about the amount of money that we spend every year on turning monuments around the world green, you could not buy the kind of publicity that we have gotten this week for the country, could you?
No, you couldn't. And I think it's emblematic of the way a lot of American people think, and indeed in other nations as well, who are of Irish ancestry. They have intense pride in it. They have intense connection to it. They have intense interest in it. I think over the years we've responded to that. They've responded to us at difficult times as well, to be fair. And I just think it's absolutely wonderful. I have to say, I was more emotional than I ever realised I would be this week, looking at him there on the TV in Carlingford and being in the Dáil yesterday. I thought he really brought some important points home.
But why, though? Because, I mean, a pragmatic, hard-headed politician like you can see this is really just a glorified photo opportunity.
No, I don't agree with that at all. I mean, especially when you see Antony Blinken there and Tom Vilsack, the Agriculture Secretary, you have really high-powered figures in the US government here. This is not just a sentiment.
Who've joined him for the photo opportunity?
No, I mean, Antony Blinken doesn't just join people for photo opportunities. He's engaged in real-world diplomacy. The US has a lot of problems at the moment. And I think the fact that he's here with the President and with the Agriculture Secretary shows how high a priority Ireland is and peace in the island of Ireland is to the US administration. I think we need to take advantage of that and work with them on lots of things, which we already do. It is good news for us economically, socially, but it's also good news for Northern Ireland as well. I think unequivocal good news that focus is on them. And I think up there, there should be maybe a little bit more of a welcome for that, I would say.
Paul Murphy, why did you choose not to welcome?
I mean, I have found the whole visit to be utterly nauseating in terms of the approach of our media and our politicians, who have been nothing but obsequious and sycophantic. There hasn't been a single critical question that I'm aware asked, not of... He's not some celebrity. He's not some interesting Irish-American figure, nor is he a god or a king. He is the leader of the most powerful country in the world. He is a warmonger. He is a climate polluter, despite what he said yesterday. He's just signed off on one of the biggest oil and gas projects in the world in Alaska, a project known as Willow. He's agreeing to more oil and gas drilling than Trump agreed to. He funds the Saudi dictatorship, despite what he said during the election, to the tune of billions of dollars of military support, which is used to kill the people of Yemen, 20,000 civilians, and not a single person raised a voice of criticism, nor was there the opportunity in the Dáil to do so. In a parliament, he gets to come, give a speech that in reality was a new Cold War type.
And that assessment may in part be true, but is he not also, as the Taoiseach said today, a man who at a time of great danger in the world, we are very fortunate we have a man of balance, experience and wisdom and at the helm when the potential threats of nuclear is there, someone who understands foreign policy intimately and knows the lines that have to be walked and navigated. Is that not also a fair assessment of Joe Biden?
I don't think so. And I would have liked to have that debate yesterday about which is the fair assessment and for us to give our opinion based on the facts. So he spoke about a world that is divided between democracy and autocracy. And I think that is preparing to say Ireland needs to come in, get closer and closer to NATO. I think this is part of the project of the undermining of what is left of neutrality. But he didn't mention the fact that actually the US provides military support to a majority of dictatorships in the world. So it is not the case that, unfortunately, Joe Biden is the leader of the free world. I mean, I saw RTE News unironically using the phrase Joe Biden as the leader of the free world. This is a country which is 20% of the world's incarcerated population is in America, a country with 4%. It's a country that's trying to extradite a journalist, Julian Assange. It's absolutely sickening.
Brenda
and
Power,
there's no reference to any of this.
Is Paul Murphy reading the room right?
No. I mean, what Paul, you were 2% in the last polls. So basically, you're a margin of error party. I honestly don't believe that your decision to stay outside yesterday put a major crimp on Joe Biden's day. I mean, the point made by Mary Lou MacDonald, I think to yourself, actually, Philip, earlier this week, was valid. You can express your reservations about Americans and your criticism of American foreign policy. But on an occasion like this, which is maybe, as you say, nothing more than a giant photo opportunity, to behave in a churlish manner like that.
I didn't say I asked. I was.
Yes, I know. But I mean, you know, if that is what it is, and if that is all it is, then it is a photo opportunity that is literally being beamed around the world. Now, I don't know if that is the case, if there's a whole lot of interest being taken outside of the US. But I suppose it's fortunate in a way that document leak happened while he was here, because you had the leading members of the American media quizzing him about it, not that he had much to say, and that was leading the news. The fact that he was in Ireland was leading the news. And you know, you cannot make your criticisms from outside. You have to be relevant. You have to be a relevant party. I don't see you having done anything yesterday,
but we weren't allowed to speak.
What would have been your objective?
But you're saying we should be in the room. We wanted
you
to be in the room.
You should have to stand up and quiz the president of America.
Like we did when the president of the European Commission like we did when the president of Ukraine spoke. Of course, it's a parliament. It isn't a soapbox for the most powerful person in the world to come and make a speech. It's ridiculous. We may be on 2%. I'm elected.
Quite frankly, Paul has no shortage of opportunities to make his point in the Dáil, no shortage in the media, everybody knows that. The reality is, when there's a guest in your house, you look after them and you treat them really well. And that's the way I looked at yesterday. And quite frankly, when you mentioned Ursula von der Leyen, she had no difficulty with this as far as I know. But the discussion there went on and on and on and on from various leaders of all parties. And quite frankly, it got a bit boring. And I thought yesterday's format was much better. It was ceremonial. It gave the president an opportunity to speak. The Count Corla and the last guy here, look, nobody else spoke in the parliament. And I thought that was a much better format than previous.
Elaine Loughlin, does Paul have a point here? The media coverage has been pretty fawning, pretty obsequious. Not much of a harsh word said there anywhere.
Well, if you look at it, it is a positive event for Ireland insofar as we are a very small nation and we are being beamed across the world, especially into America. So even from, if we're looking cynically here, it's about getting American tourists into Ireland. If they see their leader, Joe Biden, here, they might think...
But that's not the job of journalists, particularly not political correspondents.
It's not. But I think what we did yesterday was covered the speeches that were made, both from the Count Corla, from Senator Jerry Buttimer and the US President. We weren't offered an opportunity to question, just like Paul, to question the president yesterday. That just wasn't in the schedule for political correspondence. So we cover what we see and what we hear, and that's what we did yesterday.
Is that not something that the press corps should insist upon and stamp its foot and say, no, I'm sorry, this is not good enough. This is another elected representative. He's not a celebrity. He doesn't get to dictate the terms on which he engages with media.
We would love to do that, and we always do fight the case for as much opportunities as possible to, regardless of who it is, the Taoiseach, if it's Ursula von der Leyen in Ireland and if it's the US President. But this goes a lot wider. I think the Gardaí were overruled in what they did in Ireland. The Secret Service come in, the US officials come in, they scope out Ireland, which they had been doing for weeks in advance of this visit, and they set the standard, they set the rules. Even when it comes to the media, whether that's the travelling group of media from America, ourselves, and as I said, down to what the politicians could do yesterday and what members of the general public could do yesterday as well in Dublin.
We have, haven't we, Thomas Byrne, as you said, very successfully wrapped ourselves around him and he's wrapped himself around us. But it makes our claims of neutrality, particularly ahead of the forum that's being proposed, look pretty threadbare.
No, I wouldn't accept that at all. And what Ireland has done over many decades is punch above our weight in various forums, and because we've had to, because we're small. So to make an impact economically, to make an impact around the world, we've had to punch above our weight. We've done that through our connections with the Irish diaspora as one part of it. And this is just another example of that, and a very proud one. And I'm very, very proud of President Biden and his connections to Ireland. What I would say is...
Are we not, to all intents and purposes, an associate member of NATO by now, though?
No, we're not. We're not. And what I would say is, if you listen to what President Biden said yesterday, quoting JFK, said Ireland pursues an independent foreign policy, but is not neutral between autocracy and liberty. And quite frankly, I'm very happy with that sentence, very comfortable with what he said. And I think the vast majority of Irish people would be very comfortable with that as well. He wrapped up our support for Ukraine in our memory of famine and our memory of our own escape from this island in terms of our emigrants from hunger and oppression. And I think that was very, very moving.
Paul Murphy, when we look at the enormity of the threat to the whole of Europe from the East, from Russia, is now not the time to surrender on that neutrality as a sacred cow and recognise it, rather, for the sacred cow it is?
No, because while Putin is a horrific, bloody autocrat, NATO and Western imperialism are not any better. That's the truth. If you look at their role internationally, you look at the hundreds of thousands dead in the Middle East, you look at the tens of thousands dead, for example, in Yemen as a direct consequence of US support for Saudi Arabia, look at support for Israel, they're not any better. They're
I don't dispute any of those, but on this occasion, Russia aggressor, NATO defender.
Well, no, in terms of, it's true that Russia is the aggressor in terms of Ukraine, no question about it. It's a completely imperialist, unacceptable invasion, denying the right of Ukrainian people to self-determination. That's 100% correct. But NATO has its own agenda here. That agenda is not simply the defence of Ukrainian people. It's not. Because this didn't just all start happening just over a year ago. There's a prehistory to this, which is the expansion of NATO 800 kilometres eastward, the holding of significant military exercises on an annual basis at Russia's borders. That there is a history
which
of
the
NATO
Warsaw Pact countries were doing for years as well.
Exactly. And Ireland should not be part of either of these camps. And what we should be clear on is that there is an agenda to erode neutrality.
Well, we're not part of NATO. We're part of the United Nations. And it's a fundamental principle of membership of the United Nations that borders are respected and sovereignty of countries is respected. And that's why we're able to take a very clear stand
about
Ukraine.
About Yemen? Do we do that about Yemen?
Absolutely.
Do we criticise Biden for support for not respecting Yemen's borders?
I haven't seen what America has done in relation to Yemen, Paul.
Well, maybe you should open your eyes to us.
You've made a few indirect
Saudi Arabia has been bombing the crap out of Yemen for years. There are tens of thousands of civilians dead, and they're doing that with US weaponry. How don't you know that as someone who welcomed, applauded, probably whooped for Joe Biden yesterday? That's incredible.
You've never once examined our record at the UN Security Council and our record at the UN in general, not just in the last couple of years, but over many, many decades. President Biden did and referred to it yesterday, and our role around the world has been extremely positive. By not being part of NATO, not being part of a military alliance, but absolutely accepting that there are rules there in the international world that we comply with for the betterment of
our
people.
You're not going
to
try and convince me, though, that at any point during this visit did Leo Varadkar or Micheál Martin say to Joe Biden, listen, as a friend, we need to sit you down and we need to talk to you about Saudi Arabia.
I'm not part of the meetings, but I mean, this is Paul Murphy has raised this issue. We have raised lots of issues.
Okay.
If you look at our record in the UN Security Council, there's a huge range of issues that Ireland has been really, really strong about. We're one of the few that raised the plight of the education of women and girls in Afghanistan, for example. And we've used our independent voice. We haven't asked anybody's permission as to whether we can raise these issues.
Time to kill the sacred cow or not.
I don't think there's going to be any huge public support for dispensing with our neutrality in that forum that was announced, I think it was earlier this month.
That's not what I asked you, though. What's your opinion on whether we should or not?
I don't think we should either. I don't think our neutrality is going to make a whole lot of difference one way or another in the event of a global conflagration, to be quite honest. And I mean, there's a very critical article in today's Telegraph about how Ireland is basically piggybacking on the defence availability, the defence capacity of the United Kingdom and America. And that's absolutely true, because we are so strategically located that they have no option but to defend us. Apparently, two-thirds or three-quarters of all transatlantic telecommunication cables pass through the Irish Economic Zone. So any threat to Ireland is a threat to Europe and a threat to the West. So it is deeply cynical of us, you could say, to remain militarily neutral, but we cannot afford it, for one thing. Something like 0.3% of our current exchequer funds go on defence. That would have to be multiplied 100-fold if we were to acquire, say, an air force, which we do not have. If we were to have more than four naval vessels.
I know, but we could do something like acquire a military transport plane for the eventualities like happened in Kabul last year, rather than the embarrassment of having to go to the French and the Brits and say, can we hire out a plane for a while, please, lads?
But I think, you know, the cost of that, even that, was something that would have to be debated. and discuss. And I just don't think there's going to be public support for it.
I think 100 years after the foundation of the state, or slightly more now, it is one topic, just like United Ireland, that should be debated and should be discussed more widely and on a public forum. So I would welcome the initiative that Micheál Martin
Is it a foregone conclusion?
No. Not necessarily. And I think there are, a varying number of views on what neutrality even is. And even if we could get exactly in our heads as a country what we categorise as neutrality, because I'm sure there are some people would say that we gave up our neutrality many years ago the minute we allowed American boots on the ground in Shannon Airport, and we've moved on significantly since then. So I think maybe, as I said, a definition of what we view as being neutral would also be helpful, even if we don't go towards joining NATO or other measures.
Military and political neutrality. Mm-hmm. And while people are happy to be politically partisan, they're not. I don't think there'll be enthusiasm for military.
Can I just say as well, I mean, there's different concepts of neutrality within Ireland. I think there's different people have different understandings of what it is. And even among the countries that are or just were neutral in the European Union, there's different concepts in each of them and different reasons in each of them as to why they are neutral. Sweden, for example, neutral country, is looking to join NATO, but they've done joint military exercises with the US and the UK for a long, long time. I think in Ireland, sometimes the issue of neutrality is mixed up with militarism. I actually personally think, and again, there's no conclusions on this consultative forum, my personal view is that the biggest question that we have is how do we defend ourselves? Yes, theoretically it's possible we'd be invaded, but the more immediate threats, in my opinion, are in relation to those cables and in relation to cyber threats as well, which we've some direct experience of as well at the moment.
Can I get into the specifics of one question here? Because while there was a clear moral case to be made for facilitating or not facilitating the US military enterprise in Iraq and Afghanistan with the use of Shannon, Paul Murphy, would you be happy at this point in time in saying, no, do you know what? I don't care how useful Shannon might be in the transition of the passage of vital weaponry to Ukraine, none of it should pass through Ireland.
Correct. Ireland should not be facilitating US imperialism and its endeavours around the world.
Well, that doesn't
be that anywhere. 100%. We should not be doing that. It's a contradiction to neutrality.
Okay, but
as is Ireland's participation in the NATO-led Ukraine Contact Defence Group, which meets at NATO headquarters, by the way, which Ireland is currently participating, as in Ireland's participation in the EU military training mission of Ukraine. They're all breaches of neutrality.
Doesn't it make our support for Ukraine pretty empty, though, if we're going to say, no, do you know what? None of those weapons can come through Ireland.
No, because we can have a much more meaningful impact by leveraging our position as a country that should be genuinely neutral, being consistent against all oppression and imperialism. And, for example, the most meaningful
point to me the last time that was meaningfully exercised and made any difference on the world stage.
What we should do right now, you asked me a question. We should shut down the shadow banking system that's being used by Russian oligarchs.
I didn't ask you for a suggestion of what we should do. I asked you to tell me when was the last time that Irish independence and neutrality was successfully leveraged on the world stage to make a meaningful difference to world affairs.
But the reality is Ireland's neutrality has been hollowed out over decades at this stage, and what this government would like to do is to kind of formalise that arrangement. And what you have to ask in terms of these forums is we were originally promised a citizens' assembly. That was what was suggested. Then they thought, oh no, a citizens' assembly is made up of random citizens,
have
this managed process instead.
You have just admitted that Ireland's neutrality has become a fairly meaningless,
absolutely,
empty document.
Which is why we proposed a bill to have a referendum to enshrine neutrality in the Constitution, along explaining our vision of what that would mean. The government voted that down. And when you hear them talking, say, we need to have a discussion, we agree. But a discussion should be had amongst the public. Instead, what they want to have, they're afraid even of a citizens' assembly. So they're going to have this managed process of experts, many of whom will be in receipt of funding from the armaments corporations who profit from war, the only people who profit from war, telling us why we need to be mature and grow up and get rid of this neutrality. That's what we're going to see rolled out. But I have every confidence that people won't fall for it. And that's very frustrating for the government, because since Ukraine in particular, they've been trying to accelerate the process of getting rid of neutrality, but public opinion remains steadfast.
Is that what it's going to be? Thomas Byrne, he depicts it as a kind of an arms industry expo.
No, that's nonsense. You asked the question of when was the last time Ireland uses neutrality on the international stage. There's loads of examples, by the way, of that. I mean, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty is an Irish achievement, Frank Aiken. We even look back at a term of the Security Council in the last couple of years in terms of the work that was done on the border between Syria and
Nuclear
Turkey.
Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, is it now 55 years?
It's still really, really important.
It's a long time. It's still, a lifetime.
If you ever go to the UN, you will have people there telling you, thanks to Ireland for pushing this forward. The legacy is still there. But there's more recent achievements as well. Peacekeeping missions in Bosnia-Herzegovina. We got that through the UN last year, in spite of Russia's position, actually, that we managed to keep them from vetoing it, which would have been disastrous there. But also, a lot of work was done on the border between Syria and Turkey in terms of refugees and keeping a corridor open. That was led by Minister Coveney at the time as well, and our diplomats. So there's a lot being achieved on the world stage by Ireland as a neutral country. Okay. We continue to do that. But we also have to defend ourselves as a country too and be realistic about that.
And not an awful lot being achieved on the home front on the hospital overcrowding. 501 admitted patients this morning waiting for beds. Brenda, is anybody ever going to crack this nut?
I can't see how this has been allowed to continue for so long, Philip. Honestly, do you remember, it must be 30 years ago since the then late Health Minister John O'Connell described trolleys as beds with wheels, because at that time there was controversy over the number of people who were not being given beds in hospitals. That must be at least 30 years ago. How is it possible that we have remunerated heads of the HSE, Department of Health, health ministers, vast sums of money over the past decades, and nobody has been able to crack this, and it has only been getting worse? That is inexcusable, absolutely inexcusable. It's a political failure, it's a management failure, it's a failure across the board, and we shouldn't accept it. Lives are being lost. There's no question that people are dying because they're elderly people spending days on trolleys. That is utterly unacceptable. And we're too docile and we're too accepting of it.
Yeah, I think the problem is this issue is treated as if, like, you know, it's this big inexplicable thing whereby we have huge numbers of people on trolleys, hundreds of thousands of people on waiting lists, and people dying, rightly, as has been pointed out, as a consequence of that. And it's kind of, this is this black hole, you can throw money at it, but you'll never be able to deal with it. And, like, at the centre of the crisis is an issue of capacity. We had, in the 1980s, 17,500 beds in our health system. Now we have 11,000 after a massive expansion of our population. We have about half as many beds, and everything that comes with the beds, it's obviously not just the physical beds, half as many beds per capita as the EU average. That's the centre of the crisis. We need at least an extra 5,000 beds in the system. The other thing I think we have to look at is a little bit like the housing crisis. The housing crisis isn't a housing crisis for everyone. For some, it's a big opportunity to profit. The big corporate landlords, the developers, the speculators, the same with health. If you have a creaking at the seams, poor health system where people are waiting years for necessary operations, the ones who benefit from that is the private health industry, and their profits are booming. And we have to look at the agenda there, and in reality, we should be taking over the private hospitals and integrating them into the public health system.
Is there a grand conspiracy at the heart of government then, Thomas Byrne, to run the health system inefficiently for the benefit of the private health care providers?
No. I mean, if you're in an emergency situation, I mean, except for the most minor injuries, you cannot go to a private hospital. You have to go to the public hospital because that's where all the experts are, and that's where all the experts will be, and that's where the government wants all the experts to be, Paul, in accordance with Sláintecare. If you have anything serious with you at all, there is no private hospital in this country can deal with you on an urgent basis. You have to go to the local A&E. Clearly, what's going on at the moment is not something that I can come here to defend, but I also know that the government and Minister Donnelly are working really, really hard to try to alleviate this. And there was a winter plan put in place, which did have some impact. It was 169 million put in place for that. There was work done in relation to the bank holiday weekends that we've just gone through as well. And the HSE is currently developing an emergency care improvement programme to try to get to the root of this. I mean, the real problem here is that our non-hospital care is not up to the standard that we need. That's one of the big problems.
Elaine Loughlin, Thomas Byrne just used the word urgent. Do you see any urgency in government over this?
Not the urgency that's required, I think. And it goes further than trolleys. You know, people see trolleys and see elderly patients on trolleys for hours, up to 24 hours in some cases, and you hear those awful cases from time to time. But it goes deeper to that than that. And I know recently even the Oireachtas Health Committee discussed the digitisation of records, which was talked about first being rolled out on a national basis in 2017, 2018. We're here in 2023, and the business plan for rolling out a digital record system across all hospitals and GPs as well, instead of having reams of paper at the end of a bed that might get lost and doctors are searching wards for bits of paper to give to another doctor, to give to a nurse, it would be all accessible on a tablet, like in many other countries, which would save hours and then help staff. Again, would also help with the trolley situation, because you'd free up beds quicker as well. That's not in place, and they're saying now that they're waiting for the National Children's Hospital to be a guinea pig, and they'll see about rolling it out after that. So that's years down the road.
We saw, Brenda, on the issue of staff retention, the INMO previously tried to argue and got short shrift with the government that there should be a Dublin allowance paid similar to the London allowance that's paid into NHS staff. Now the INTO are looking for the same thing for teachers. Do you think they're going to get anywhere?
I don't know that they're going to get anywhere, but they have a very arguable case for that, because it is clearly not possible to expect people who have studied and gone to college and got their degrees to live like students in shared bedrooms so that they can work in a Dublin school or in a Dublin hospital. So there has to be some consideration. I know there's no magic money tree, and that this will have to come out of the funding for education or for health, but you know, it is a false economy not to help people to stay in hospitals and schools in Dublin. We are understaffed. The schools are struggling to find teachers, because they're leaving, they're moving down the country, or they're going to Dubai, where apparently they can earn 42,000 a year plus a 1,500 a month living allowance.
The London allowance is £6,500 sterling. I wonder, would a similar sum in this country, Elaine, actually make any difference?
I don't know as well if you can compare London to Dublin, because London is such a vast city as well, that you can't just simply live on the outskirts and commute in, whereas you could do that in Dublin. And the fear, I think, possibly amongst government anyway, would be that you would have a lot of teachers living on the outskirts, commuting in and maybe trying to then get school places in Dublin, and then you wouldn't be able to get positions in the likes of Carlow, Kildare, Meath, Louth, where people could easily commute into Dublin for the higher salary.
Gaming the system. Is there any, Thomas Byrne, any credible argument against paying some kind of an allowance given the cost of living in the capital city?
No, it's difficult to argue against, so I'm not going to. I can absolutely see the...
So it's passed on the nod then, is it?
No, it's not. No, it's, see, this is the difficulty. It's not. And Brenda's, in fairness to Brenda, she has outlined the difficulties with this. I know some of the unions have sought this now. I'm not sure to what extent it has been pushed in pay negotiations. And I think one of the successes that this country has had in terms of our overall economy in the last 20, 30 years has been those national negotiations on public pay. And anything like this has to come through that. We had a huge priority in recent years to make sure that...
Where you will have to give the same thing to everybody once one sector receives it, so that's going to nail that one.
Well, look, I mean, the priority for the last number of years was the new entrants, particularly with teachers, but it also applied to other professions as well. Okay. That has basically been dealt with now, so maybe it's time now to look at this issue, because it is certainly a difficulty for people working in Dublin and indeed in the commuter belt.
Thomas Byrne, Paul Murphy, Elaine Loughlin, Brenda Parra, thank you all very much. That's all that I have time for today. That is it for the week. I'll be back with you in Countrywide tomorrow at 8 o'clock, though do wake up for that. Today's programme was produced by Rachel Graham, researcher Kieran Dunn, broadcast coordinator Jarlath Holland, and on sound Mark McGrath. Now, at midday, here's Louise.